Okay. So, briefly, ladies and gentlemen, it is both a pleasure and an honor to welcome Brian Moore to the Collège de France as an invited speaker. Many thanks, Brian, for joining us today. I could go for hours about Brian Moore's achievements, but he does not really need much of an introduction. As a world leader in psychoacoustic, most of you already know a lot about him. Brian Moore obtained a BA in natural sciences from Cambridge, followed by a PhD in experimental psychology, again from Cambridge, in 1971. He then taught at the University of Reading before returning to Cambridge. In 1985, he was a visiting researcher at the University of California at Berkeley, and in 1995, he became professor at the University of Cambridge. His work has focused on the mechanism of normal hearing and hearing impairment and has resulted in major breakthroughs in the domain of frequency discrimination with the role of filtering, bandwidth, and the introduction of various types of masking curve leading to the development of psychophysics tuning curve in particular. His research has also addressed the relationship between auditory ability and speech perception, the design of signal processing systems for hearing aids for sensorineural hearing loss, and the perception of music. He is an international expert in speech. Over the course of his career, Brian Moore has published more than 600 papers and book chapters. His most famous book, I think, is An Introduction to the Psychology of Hearing, a book that has become a key reference in the field. But you have also written 18 other books. Brian Moore became a fellow of the Royal Society in London in 2002. He is also a fellow of the Academy of Medical Science. He has received so many prestigious awards that I can cite only a few here. The Acoustic Society of America awarded him its silver medal in 2003, its gold medal in 2014. He has been awarded the Littler Prize and has delivered the Littler Lecture of the British Society of Audiology. And in 2014, he received the Award of Merit from the Association of Research of Otorhinolaryngology. Last but not least, my internet research on our speaker led me to discover another little known role of Brian Moore as a wine steward of a college in Cambridge.
Yes.
So, could this mean that Brian Moore is also an expert in the domain of olfaction? Perhaps he will tell us more about this aspect later on, but for now, I think that we should start it and discuss the perception of pitch. Brian, the floor is now yours.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry I'm going to speak in English, but if there's anything I say that's not clear, put your hand up and I'll try to clarify and explain. So first, a definition of pitch. This is the official definition of the American National Standards Institute. So it's the aspect of auditory sensation in terms of which sounds can be ordered on a musical scale going from low to high. So pitch is something that we hear to be distinguished from frequency, which is a physical attribute. And musicians often mix up the two. Musicians say this note has a pitch of A, 4, but in psychoacoustics, we like to separate pitch, which is what you hear, from frequency, which is a physical correlate. And of course, variations in pitch give rise to a sense of melody. So if I go da 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 da, everyone recognizes the tune, and that's played by varying the pitch. And pitch plays an important role in many aspects of perception. Obviously, in the context of music, it's important for hearing melodies. When two or more voices or two or more instruments are singing or playing at the same time, the fact that they have different pitches helps us to hear those individual sounds. And of course, in music, the frequency ratios between notes are important for the perception of harmony. And in normal speech perception, patterns of pitch variation help to convey intonation and stress, so we can judge whether something is a statement or a question, for example. And then there are some languages where the actual meanings of the words are affected by the pitch patterns. So pitch plays an important role in many aspects of hearing. I want to start by talking about a very simple kind of sound called a sine wave or a pure tone, which has a waveform looking something like this. And this is the type of sound that would be produced by a tuning fork. But sine waves also produce particularly simple responses in the auditory system. Here's an example of a fairly low frequency sine wave. Well, all right, that one's not working, but they've stopped again. They were going earlier. Well, it's... That's what they would sound like. So these... What I was intending to illustrate, I hope some of the later demonstrations will work, is that this one here has twice the frequency of this one, and they sound an octave apart. So in music, two notes that have a frequency ratio of 2 to 1 sound as though they're related in a special way, and we perceive it in terms of an octave. Now, Joseph Fourier, a famous Frenchman, said that any periodic sound, any sound that repeats regularly as a function of time, can be broken down into a series of sinusoidal components with specific frequencies, amplitudes, and phases. And sounds that have a pitch generally are periodic. They repeat regularly as a function of time. And Fourier's theorem said that we can consider any sound that repeats regularly as composed of a number of sinusoidal components. And when the sound is strictly periodic, then each of those components is referred to as a harmonic. And generally in periodic sounds, the first harmonic is also called the fundamental frequency or the fundamental component, and it has a frequency equal to the repetition rate of the sound as a whole, and the nth harmonic has a frequency that is n times the fundamental frequency. So, and n is an integer. So a typical sound produced by a musical instrument would have a series of harmonics. For example, the frequencies could be 200, 400, 600, 800, and so on. And so we can represent sounds in two ways. One, by the waveform, which is just the pressure variation as a function of time. So this is the waveform of a sine wave, and its spectrum just has one component, a single harmonic. This is the fundamental component. A more complex sound would be a square wave, which has a series of harmonics, but the square wave is unusual in that it has only odd harmonics. It has the first, the third, the fifth, the seventh, and the ninth, but the even harmonics are missing. And some musical instruments have a spectrum rather like that. For example, the clarinet has mainly odd harmonics. A sound that's been popular in auditory research is a series of brief pulses, which is a very sharp, buzzy kind of sound, but it's useful for research purposes because it has many harmonics and they all have the same amplitude. So that's a convenient way of generating a sound with many harmonics, all of the same amplitude. Now, as I said, most complex sounds that we listen to, musical sounds, are composed of a series of harmonics. Let's see if this works. Okay, that works. So that's the fundamental component. Here's the second harmonic. Third harmonic. And the fourth harmonic. And if I play them all together, what you hear normally is a single note. It's got a more rich timbre than any of the harmonics, but it has the same pitch as the fundamental component. So if I play that, and then play that, they're pretty much the same pitch, very close anyway. So this sound, this complex sound, is actually composed of four harmonics, but we tend to hear a single pitch corresponding to the fundamental component. Now, and I'll talk about more about the mechanisms that underlie that later on, but I just want to briefly take you through how sounds are analysed in the auditory system. So any sound that enters the ear travels down the ear canal, causes the eardrum to vibrate, and those vibrations are transmitted through these three small bones into the cochlea. And it's in the cochlea where all the really interesting things happen. Now, the cochlea has a spiral shape, but that doesn't seem to matter. It's coiled up like a snail, but you can imagine uncoiling it, and it wouldn't make any difference to how it works. There are one or two people who claim it does make a difference, but I think it doesn't. And it's coiled up just to get it into a small space in the head. So there's not much volume available. So we can uncoil it, and running along its length, there's a membrane called the basilar membrane. And when a sound is transmitted into the cochlea, it leads to a pressure difference across the basilar membrane between the top and the bottom of this ribbon. And this sets up a wave that travels along the basilar membrane. And here's an example of the kind of wave that you might see if you were looking sideways on at this ribbon. So the wave appears to travel from one end to the other. So this end here is the end closest to where the sound gets into the cochlea, the stapes, which is producing the vibration that goes into the ear. The other end is called the apex, that's this tip of this coiled up structure. But you would actually see the same pattern of vibration if you delivered the sound somewhere else. And many years ago, von Beckersee drilled a hole at the apex of the cochlea, delivered sound pressure variations there, and saw exactly the same pattern of vibration. So, and this pattern of vibration depends upon the physical properties of the basilar membrane. So as I said, the end of the basilar membrane close to the stapes is called the base, and the other end is called the apex. And the basilar membrane is stiff and narrow at the base. And what I mean by stiff is if you poke it with a soft fiber or something like that, like a bristle from a pig, you poke the basilar membrane and it will resist movement at the base. But if you press at the apex, it will flex much more. It's much more easily bent. And it's also wider. The ribbon varies in width along the length of the cochlea. And because of those changes in physical properties, each place is tuned to a specific frequency. And the peak of this traveling wave occurs towards the base of the cochlea for high frequencies and towards the apex for low frequencies. So there's a mapping from frequency to place within the cochlea. And so frequency may be represented by the place that has the maximum amplitude of vibration on the basilar membrane. And that's often called a place code. So that's one way in which the frequency of a sound is represented. And Hellman von Helmholtz proposed many years ago that the pitch of sound is represented by the place of maximum excitation in the cochlea. Now, I am a great fan of Helmholtz. I think he was an incredible man, but I think on this particular thing, he wasn't right, and we'll come to that later on. And all that this work discovering these patterns of vibration on the basilar membrane was performed by Georg von Bakersee, and he got the Nobel Prize for this work in 1961. Now, that the simulated travelling wave on the basilar membrane that I showed you earlier was typical of what von Bakersee measured, but we now know that in a normal, healthy ear, the travelling wave has a sharper peak. The outline or envelope of the travelling wave is much sharper than I illustrated earlier. And it's now believed that there's an active biological mechanism that sharpens the tuning on the basilar membrane and enhances the response to weak sounds. And that's called the active mechanism. And this is typical of what you would see in a normal healthy ear. You get a much higher peak, and so you've got a sharper pattern of vibration. And that active mechanism appears to depend on the operation of the outer hair cells in the cochlea. And the outer hair cells are very easily damaged by intense sounds or by getting older. And if you're as old as me, you probably have a hearing loss, at least at high frequencies, and you've partially lost this active mechanism. So my active mechanism is not as active as it used to be. Now, there's another way in which information about frequency is coded. Information about the vibration on the basilar membrane is signaled to the brain by brief electrical pulses called nerve spikes or action potentials in the neurons that make up the auditory nerve. And these nerve spikes occur at roughly a constant phase of the waveform on the basilar membrane. And that means that the time intervals between nerve spikes are approximately integer multiples, whole number multiples, of the period of the waveform. So here's an example of a 500 hertz input signal. And in response to a 500 hertz input, if you look at the place on the basilar membrane tuned to 500 hertz, it will be going up and down 500 times per second. And the nerve spikes tend to occur as the wave is moving up on the basilar membrane. And so you tend to get spikes at the same phase of the wave each time. You generally don't get a spike on every cycle of the stimulus, but when you do get a spike, it's locked to a particular phase. And so these time intervals between spikes are integer multiples of the period of that sound. So this interval is about 4 milliseconds, this interval is about 2 milliseconds, this about 2, and this one about 6. So the spikes are not completely regular, but the time intervals between them are carrying information about the frequency of the sound. And if I had an electrode just in that one neuron, I could get a very precise estimate of the frequency of the sound. Now, phase locking is most precise at low frequencies, below about 1,000 hertz, and it becomes weaker at high frequencies. But the upper limit varies across different species of animals. The barn owl seems to be the best. It has good phase locking up to 9 kilohertz or so. And the upper limit in humans is not known. There are some attempts to measure with electrodes on the surface of the cochlea, but they're not directly measuring what's going on in the auditory nerve. So we still don't know the limit in people. But I would like to argue that frequency and pitch may be coded in the patterns of phase locking, which I refer to as temporal fine structure, or TFS, at least for low and medium frequencies. And later on I'll discuss just what the upper limit is, and I believe the upper limit is higher than most other people believe, so I have to say that I'm slightly out on a limb here. I'm at the extreme of the temporal theory people. But this kind of code is called a temporal code. So I want now to talk a bit about pitch theories for sine waves, and then I'll go on to talk about complex tones. So the place theory of pitch says that the pitch that we perceive is related to the place of maximum response on the basilar membrane. The temporal theory says that the perceived pitch is related to the time intervals between nerve spikes, and it cannot apply at very high frequencies. So even if, like me, you believe in a temporal theory, you have to assume that at very high frequencies it breaks down and you have a transition to a place mechanism. But one question is, where does that transition occur? How high is high? Well, one way that that's been studied is by measuring the ability to detect small changes in frequency. And I'll just play you a little demonstration. You'll hear a series of tones, and the one tone is always fixed at 1,000 hertz, and it alternates with a tone with a slightly different frequency. And I start with a difference of about 40 hertz, so it goes 1,040, and then it goes 1,030, and then 1,010, and the difference gradually gets smaller. And at the end, there's a difference of only 2 or 3 hertz. So listen to that sequence and see if you can keep hearing that difference in frequency. Okay, and probably most of you could hear it right up to the end. And so people can detect very small differences in frequency around 1 kilohertz, 2 or 3 hertz. So 0.2 or 0.3 of a percent can be detected quite often. So we have a very good ability to do this. Now, on a logarithmic frequency scale, the sharpness of tuning on the basilar membrane is at least as great at high frequencies as it is at low frequencies. The relative tuning, the tuning relative to the sender frequency, is pretty much constant at medium and high frequencies. If anything, it's a bit sharper at very high frequencies than at medium frequencies. So according to the place theory, you would predict that the smallest detectable change in frequency, expressed as the smallest detectable change divided by the frequency, in other words, as a proportion, that should depend on the sharpness of tuning on the basilar membrane. And since that's roughly constant, we predict that delta F over F should not increase at high frequencies. The smallest proportional change that we can detect should be roughly constant across frequencies. Whereas, according to the temporal theory, this proportion, delta F over F, should increase once you get above about 1,000 hertz as phase locking weakens. But then eventually you should reach a plateau where the place mechanism has taken over. Well, this is an issue. So this is the kind of pattern of results that we might expect. If we plot center frequency along here, and we plot the smallest detectable change in frequency as a proportion of the center frequency, we expect to see a pattern of results looking something like this. If a temporal theory applies, at lower frequencies, we expect performance to worsen as the frequency goes up, and then to reach a plateau when the place mechanism takes over. Whereas if there was only a place mechanism, then you'd just expect to see something that was fairly flat across this whole range. So this is something that I actually looked at when I did my PhD thesis, and these are some results from my PhD work. So center frequency is plotted here, and this is a measure of the smallest detectable change in frequency as a proportion of the center frequency. And what you can see is that there is an increase in delta F over F at high frequencies, as predicted by the temporal theory, but There's no sign of a plateau. There's no sign of anything flattening off at the higher frequencies. So, well, what is going on here? So I thought about this for another 30 or 40 years, and finally I thought, well, what happens if we test at even higher frequencies? Do we see a plateau then? So 39 years later, it took a long time to turn over in my mind, we did an experiment where we included frequencies up to 14 kilohertz. So this is the range that we looked at before, up to 8,000 hertz, and we get a similar pattern of results. But things do eventually flatten off. There is a sign of a plateau, but it only occurs when you get up to 8 to 10 kilohertz. So I take this as evidence that even at these very high frequencies, up to 8 kilohertz, there's some weak phase locking that's enough to allow frequency discrimination better than you get from a place mechanism. Eventually, the place mechanism does play a role, but only at really high frequencies. But I have to say that many people are skeptical about this. This is my view, but it's controversial. Now, another thing that changes at high frequencies is the way that we perceive musical intervals. A man called Backham proposed many years ago that there are two dimensions to pitch. And one aspect of pitch is called tone height, and it's related monotonically to frequency. The higher the frequency, the higher the tone height. But the other aspect is related to the class of the note or the name of the note and is called tone chroma. So two tones separated by one octave have the same tone chroma and they sound similar to one another in some way. And that's true throughout the world. It's not a cultural thing. You can find remote tribes in the Amazon and they still perceive the octave as special. So it seems to be something that's inbuilt. And this sense of tone chroma is important for perceiving musical intervals and melodies. And it turns out that our sense of tone chroma weakens markedly above 5 kilohertz. So one task that has been used to look at this is octave matching. And if I present you with a 1,000 hertz tone and then give you a knob that you can use to adjust a second tone, and I say adjust it to be an octave higher than this one, most people will adjust it close to 2,000. Everyone can do that, and they can do it quite accurately, unless you have this funny condition called amusia. There is a sort of a neurological defect in pitch in some people, but most people can do an octave match quite accurately. But if I present a tone at, say, 4,000 hertz and ask you to adjust another tone to be an octave higher, you might expect to match around 8,000, but the matches are all over the place. People don't do it consistently, and it varies from one person to another. And similarly, melodies become harder to identify. Now, I'm going to play you a demonstration here that I can't hear at all. And some of you may not be able to hear it. I'm playing you a melody that's made of tones all with very high frequencies, all above 10 kilohertz. Now, I can't hear tones above 10 kilohertz anymore because of my age, but some of you may be able to. And I want you to see if you can recognize this tune played around 10 kilohertz. How many people could hear it, first of all? Okay, something is happening. And how many people thought they recognized the melody? A few people did, and that's typical. I find typically about 5 to 10% of people recognize the melody. Now I'm going to play you exactly the same melody at lower frequencies. So all the same frequency ratios. And that's a Christmas carol in English, Good King Wenceslas, with the rhythm slightly distorted. It's obviously, it's a bit loud. Let me see if I can, I'll just come out of this for a second and turn down the volume slightly. Okay. Yeah, so generally melody recognition worsens at high frequencies. And another thing that happens is some people have an ability called absolute pitch. You can just play them a tone. Yeah.
I was wondering, is there any hysteresis effect to the repetition of the first very high melody? So if you play it again now, will people be more able to recognize it?
Probably people, let me play it again and see, yeah. Yeah, once you've heard it, it's easier. And you can hear the contour at high frequencies, and I could hear it when I was younger, but maybe the musical intervals themselves don't sound quite so clear. I think that's what most people find. And as I said, people with absolute pitch who can normally name a note, so you can just play them a 440 and they'll say that's an A, but if you play them a tone at say 10 kilohertz, then they can't name it anymore. And generally they get poorer at doing this above 4 to 5 kilohertz. So for musical interval judgments, things seem to break down about 4 to 5 kilohertz. And what I would argue is you need fairly precise temporal information for perception of chroma and musical intervals, but you can still use the weak temporal information between 5 and 8 kilohertz to detect a change in frequency, to detect that something is different. And then at higher frequencies still, you only have the place information to go on, and then you have a very weak sense of pitch. So I want to talk a bit now about the pitch of complex tones. And I illustrated to you earlier that for a periodic complex tone, we normally hear a pitch corresponding to the fundamental frequency. But the fundamental component does not need to be there in order for you to hear a pitch corresponding to the fundamental. So that's called the phenomenon of the missing fundamental. And when it was first discovered, some people described it as an illusion. They said it's an auditory illusion, you're hearing a pitch corresponding to something that's not there. And I think it's not an illusion, it's a consequence of the way the auditory system normally works. Now, if you make a tone that only contains some higher harmonics, say it contains the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th harmonics, you still hear a pitch corresponding to the missing fundamental. And that pitch has been given several different names. It's been called residue pitch, it's been called virtual pitch, and it's been called low pitch. But I just want to illustrate the phenomenon to you. And this is a demonstration I've taken from a compact disc produced by the Acoustical Society of America. And you'll hear a tune which is played alternately by a pure tone at the fundamental frequency and a group of high harmonics. But you should hear that the pure tones and the harmonics are giving the same melody. Now, again, when this phenomenon was first discovered, some people claimed that it was a result of a distortion process in the ear, that although the fundamental component was not in the physical stimulus, maybe there was some distortion in the ear that regenerated the fundamental component. And you can show that that is not correct because you can play a low frequency noise that masks the fundamental component, and you still hear this low pitch. I'll play you a demonstration of that. This was first demonstrated by a man called Licklider in the USA, and this demonstration is sort of based on his findings. So. Okay, so you're hearing a low pitch, but it's not coming from the part of the basilar membrane that normally responds to low frequencies. And as I said, that pitch has been given various names. So I want to next play you a demonstration of the analysis of a complex sound in the ear, so along the basilar membrane. And this demonstration was produced by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, that's what that stands for, and it was coordinated and designed by a man called Jim Hudspeth, who's a very eminent physiologist. But this is to give you an idea of what happens on the basilar membrane in response to complex sounds rather than pure tones.
So here we are with a view of the cochlea. The cochlea now uncoils, and we look at the basilar membrane, and now see what happens when we play individual tones.
Too
now
left.
A chord. And finally, something really complex.
Okay, that's quite fun, I think. Now here's a much drier illustration of how it works. So here I've got this artificial input signal, a train of brief pulses, and if you have a very good memory, you'll recall that sound has a large number of harmonics, and each harmonic has the same amplitude. And what this figure illustrates is the pattern of vibration that you would see at different places along the basilar membrane. So the number here indicates the frequency that each place is tuned to. So here we have a place tuned to 200 hertz, here we have a place tuned to 6,400 hertz. And what is plotted is the vibration on the basilar membrane as a function of time. So if you imagine you're looking sideways on and looking at how the basilar membrane is vibrating up and down. Now, this pulse train is repeating 200 times a second, and it has a fundamental component at 200 hertz. And if we look at the place tuned to 200 hertz, we see we have a sinusoidal vibration at 200 hertz, with less vibration at places on either side. So there would be a local peak in the response on the basilar membrane, and that place on the basilar membrane would be responding largely to the fundamental component on its own. It's kind of been separated out from the other components. And you would see a pattern of phase locking in neurons connected to that place on the basilar membrane. Those neurons would be phase locked to 200 hertz. Here, we're looking at the response of a place tuned to the second harmonic at 400 hertz. And that place is responding largely to that harmonic. It's as if only that harmonic was there. And there's less response at places tuned to frequencies on either side. So these lower harmonics are described as resolved harmonics because they're separated out on the basilar membrane. They're isolated. And we have some ability to hear those individual harmonics in a complex tone like that. And I'll play you a demonstration of that a bit later on. But now look at what happens up here at a place tuned to higher frequencies. Here, the individual sinusoidal components or harmonics are not separated out. Several of them interfere on the basilar membrane to give a more complex waveform. So now we have a waveform which is repeating at the same rate as the original pulse train, repeating 200 times a second, but we don't see responses to the individual harmonics anymore. And correspondingly, we are not able to hear out individual high harmonics in these complex sounds. We're quite good, we can listen analytically and hear individual low harmonics, but we can't hear individual high harmonics. So here's a demonstration. This demonstration uses a trick to draw your attention to individual harmonics. What happens is that you first hear a complex tone with all harmonics at equal amplitude, and then the fundamental component is taken away and put back again, and that draws your attention to it, and you hear it, and it comes in and out. Then the same thing is done for the second harmonic, then for the third, and so on. And you should hear these tones popping out as when they're suppressed and put back again. I hope this isn't... This may still be a little bit loud for some people. I'll just turn it down slightly more. Okay. Now the second harmonic. Now the third. Now the fourth. Now the fifth. Okay, I'll stop that there. So, but it turns out that when you measure the ability to hear out these harmonics, it does get worse when you get towards the higher harmonics. So the harmonics that we can hear out are resolved harmonics. They're the ones that are separated out on the basilar membrane. And generally, harmonics 1 to 4 are well resolved. They're very easy to hear out. Harmonics 5 to 8 are just resolved. We can hear them out, but it's a little bit more difficult. And then generally harmonics above the 8th are unresolved. We can't hear them out at all, usually. Now, when a complex tone contains low resolved harmonics, we usually hear a clear pitch. There's no problem in hearing the pitch at all. But if a complex tone contains only very high, unresolved harmonics, the pitch is less clear, but people can still hear a pitch clearly enough to hear a melody. And I'm going to play you a demonstration of that. This is another tune that may be familiar to some of you. To make this more tricky, to stop you listening to individual harmonics, I've randomly varied which harmonics are present in the complex sound. They're all high harmonics, but there's a random variation in which harmonics are present, which may throw you off a little bit. But try to listen for this low pitch, the residue pitch, and see if you can recognize the melody. Who thought they recognized it? Quite a lot. It's Yankee Doodle. Yankee do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. So let me play it again and see if you can hear it now. Yeah, as I say. So but the pitch is not crystal clear. It's sort of a little bit unclear. So generally, low harmonics give a nice clear pitch, high harmonics give a less clear pitch. And there's a transition region in between. So if you have tones with harmonics in the range 9 to 6, it's still a pretty good pitch. And then when you get to really high harmonics, when they're all above the 16th, the pitch gets very fuzzy indeed. So one way that you can interpret this is that if you have tones with low resolved harmonics, There's a two-stage process. The brain first determines the frequencies of individual harmonics, and it may extract information about the frequency of individual harmonics, either from the place of maximum vibration on the basilar membrane or from phase locking. I think that phase locking is probably involved in that. And that information is sent up the brain, and somewhere higher up in the brain, the pitch is figured out from the patterning of the frequencies. So there's a kind of central pattern recognition process involved. Now, if you have only very high harmonics, I think that the pitch must be determined from timing information, but from the time intervals between peaks in the temporal envelope of the vibration on the basilar membrane. So here the harmonics are completely unresolved, but you get a little burst of nerve spikes at each peak in the envelope, and the time intervals between those bursts of spikes determine the pitch, but that only gives you a rather weak pitch. And then there's another case where for tones with the intermediate harmonics in the range 9 to 16, I think that pitch is determined by the time intervals between peaks in the temporal fine structure close to adjacent envelope maxima. Now that sounds very complex, so I'm going to go back to this figure. Imagine we have a tone that only has harmonics in this frequency region here. You might get from a neuron that's connected to this place on the basilar membrane, you might get a nerve spike at this peak in the temporal fine structure, and then you might get another nerve spike at this peak in the temporal fine structure, and then the brain infers the pitch from the time interval between those peaks. But these are nerve spikes synchronized to the fine structure, not just to the envelope. Well, how can we test that idea? Well, one way that you can test this idea is by creating inharmonic tones. So let's imagine that we start with a tone that's got three fairly high harmonics at 1800, 2000, and 2200. And that will create a pitch corresponding to 200 hertz. You'll hear a low pitch corresponding to that. And then what you can do is shift each harmonic up by the same amount in hertz. And it turns out that that does not change the envelope repetition rate, but it changes the temporal fine structure. And here's an illustration of that. Here's the waveform of the harmonic tone with just three harmonics, and the waveform repeats regularly, and we imagine that you get nerve spikes at these times 1, 2, and 3, and 1 dash, 2 dash, and 3 dash, and then you might be able to infer the pitch from the time between 2 and 2 dash, or 1 and 1 dash. Here's what happens when you make the sound inharmonic. Now it's not repeating exactly as a function of time. So here we've got a peak labeled 2 in the temporal fine structure, very close to an envelope maximum, and here the peak is slightly shifted relative to the envelope maximum. These two sounds have the same envelope repetition rate. The overall envelope is still repeating 200 times a second, but there's a slight shift in the temporal fine structure. And the question is, well, do we hear a change in pitch corresponding to that shift in the temporal fine structure? And this issue was actually looked at by a Dutchman called Schouten, although I think it's pronounced Houten, something like that. And he actually studied this as early as 1938, I think. But it turns out that you do hear a pitch shift, provided the harmonics are not too high. And here's an example of a tone that starts as a harmonic tone with just a few high harmonics, and then each harmonic is shifted up in small steps, and hopefully you'll hear a pitch that changes, and at some point the pitch may jump down again. The pitch of sounds like this is ambiguous. If I go back to here, there's a possible pitch corresponding to each of these different time intervals. So the most prominent pitch may be the one corresponding to 2 to 2 dash, but you might hear a pitch corresponding to the interval 1 to 2 dash or 2 to 1 dash. So there are several possible pitches, and it's like an ambiguous figure. You tend to only perceive one pitch at a time, but your attention may jump from one to the other. And in this example, although the components are going up progressively in frequency, at some point you may hear a jump downwards in pitch, but that will vary according to each individual. Eventually it gets back to where it started at this tone, but did anyone hear a jump down in pitch during that? Yeah, not everyone, but some people did. So this, the fact that you hear such pitch shifts, I think supports the idea that we are sensitive to temporal fine structure when the lowest harmonic that you can hear is in the range 9 to 16. But if you make these sounds out of really high harmonics, say at 18, 19, and 20, people don't hear these pitch shifts anymore. So I think when the harmonic number gets too high, we lose our sensitivity to temporal fine structure. And as I said, the pitch can be ambiguous, and you can alternate these sounds with a pure tone and ask the person to adjust the pure tone to match each pitch that they hear. And when you do that, you find that each pitch that they hear corresponds to one of these time intervals between the prominent peaks in the temporal fine structure. But for very high frequencies, we seem not to be sensitive to the temporal fine structure anymore, and we only hear a rather weak pitch based on the temporal envelope. Now, I've already mentioned a little bit about individual differences, but it turns out there can be some quite striking individual differences when you present tones with only a few low harmonics. And when you present such a tone with only a few low harmonics, some people are what are called analytic listeners. They hear pitches corresponding to the individual harmonics. And other people are synthetic listeners. They fuse the harmonics together and they hear a pitch corresponding to the missing fundamental. And I'm going to play you an example where the sound is composed of just two harmonics. And in the first tone that you'll hear, these harmonics are the fourth and fifth harmonics of a missing fundamental of 200 hertz. And you can either hear these as two individual harmonics or as a single low pitch. Then the second tone in the pair has two harmonics at 750 and 1,000 hertz. And these are the third and fourth harmonics of 250. Now, if you're listening to the individual components, you'll hear the pitch go down because one component stays the same and the other one goes down. If you're a synthetic listener and you're listening to the missing fundamental, you'll hear it go up. So let's play the demonstration and say whether that you hear the pitch go up or down. Well, now, how many heard it go up? Not many. How many heard it go down? The great majority, yeah. So most of you are analytic listeners when you have only two harmonics. But generally, if we have a lot of harmonics, it becomes completely unambiguous, and you hear the pitch corresponding to the missing fundamental. And most musical instruments and human voices produce sounds with many harmonics. So usually it's quite clear that you hear a pitch corresponding to the missing fundamental, but with these artificial tones, you can hear it one way or the other. And it turns out there was a little bit of background noise there. If you add more background noise, that tends to promote synthetic listening, where you tend to fuse all the components and hear a single low pitch. And I want to describe an extreme example of that, described by a Dutchman called Tammo Houtgast. And he showed that you could perceive a residue pitch with just one high harmonic, which sounds completely nuts. You listen to a single high tone and you hear a low pitch. How does that happen? Well, it all depends on the context in which you're listening. So what he did was to start by presenting a complex tone in noise, and that complex tone contained several harmonics. So like they're all harmonics of 200 hertz, but it's fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth harmonics. And he presented them in noise, which promotes this synthetic mode of listening. And what he did was to actually vary the fundamental frequency to play a tune. So you kept the same harmonics, but you're varying the fundamental frequency and you play people a tune and they get used to listening to fundamental frequencies in a certain region. And then gradually, secretly, without telling the subjects, he removed the higher harmonics, still playing tunes to them. And eventually, only 800 hertz was left, and he's varying 800 hertz up at high frequencies, and people are hearing a low pitch down at the lower frequencies. And I've tried this myself, and it really works. You just can't believe it, you know, what difference the context makes. So, especially when we're listening in noise or when we're listening to one instrument with a lot of other instruments present, we tend to focus on the missing fundamental, and that's what we tend to hear. And I'd like to just finish up with a fun demonstration that's created by a special kind of a complex tone that has harmonics at one octave intervals. So you don't have all the harmonics, but you add together a series of components, each of which is higher than the next by an octave. And it has a sound quality a bit like an organ, because in organs you often have several pipes playing at the same time, tuned an octave apart. And what you do is to pass this complex tone through a filter that emphasizes the medium frequencies and attenuates low and high frequencies. And I should say that this kind of tone was first described by Shepard, and they're called Shepard tones, and Shepard was a man based at Stanford. But I'm going to play you a version of this by a Frenchman, Jean-Claude Risset, who generated this more fun version where you listen to a sound where all of these components are moving downwards. So you hear a pitch that's going down continuously, but it doesn't get anywhere. it never really goes down. So it's like one of these illusory staircases or something like that. So. And of course, if you're really listening analytically, you may hear an individual high harmonic creep in at the top end and then gradually fade out at the bottom end. But Risset has another version of this where the pitch is continually gliding down, but the tone gradually gets higher because he shifts the envelope, the filter, he shifts upwards. So you hear a tone that's continually gliding down in pitch, but ends up higher than where it started, which is also quite fun. So that's the main part of what I wanted to say. So I'll just give you some sort of conclusions and take-home messages. I think that for sine waves or pure tones, the pitch depends on temporal information from phase locking over most of the range of fundamental frequencies of musical instruments. The highest note on the piano is about 4,000 hertz. The highest note on the piccolo is maybe 4,500. And over that whole range, I think we use temporal information from phase locking to determine the pitch and to give us our sense of musical interval. And I think that reasonably good temporal information is needed to perceive tone chroma and musical intervals, and so our sense of the octave and our sense of musical intervals tends to be lost when we get up to really high frequencies. But the very weak phase locking that exists between 4,000 and 8,000 hertz may be used for detecting changes in frequency, and we only go over to a place code when you get to really high frequencies above 8,000. And for complex tones with low resolved harmonics, I think that there's a two-stage process. First, the brain extracts information about the frequencies of individual harmonics, probably using both place and temporal information from phase locking, and then the brain infers the pitch from the patterning of the extracted frequencies. And I illustrated to you that when you have tones with only a few low harmonics, you can listen either analytically or you can listen synthetically, where you fuse the harmonics together, and there are individual differences in that. And in that demonstration I played you, most of you were analytic listeners, but that demonstration was originally produced by another Dutchman called Adrian Houtsma, and he was a synthetic listener, and he just would not believe that other people were hearing it differently from him. And he said, "What's the matter with you people? Can't you hear at the low pitch?" No. So there are individual differences, and I've illustrated to you that context can play a role, and under some conditions you can hear a missing fundamental pitch even when you only have a single harmonic. And for complex tones with harmonics in the range 9 to 16, I think pitch is determined largely from phase locking to the temporal fine structure. So pitch is determined from the time interval between peaks in the temporal fine structure. That's where you tend to get the nerve spikes. So you've got an envelope peak here, an envelope peak here, and you've got fine structure within that. You get a nice spike here and a spike here, and then you measure that interval, and that's what determines the pitch that you hear. And as I pointed out, the pitch of such tones is ambiguous. More than one pitch may be heard, and different people may hear different pitches. And finally, for complex tones with only very high harmonics, the pitch is determined by the time intervals between adjacent peaks in the temporal envelope, and that gives a rather weak kind of pitch, but still can convey a sense of melody. And I think that the kind of pitch that you get with these very high harmonics is probably quite similar to the pitch received by people with cochlear implants. They're getting pitch cues based on temporal envelope timing, and it's a rather weak pitch. So the perception of pitch through cochlear implants is never as clear or precise as for acoustic hearing. And I just like to acknowledge these bodies for funding my research over the years, and these people who all collaborated in the pitch work. Thank you very much.